Okey-doke. So I'm going to talk to you about an analysis that that I've conducted with colleagues on the recovery strategies for Canada's species at risk. And the Species at Risk Act in Canada is commonly abbreviated SARA, so that's probably the lingo I'm going to slip into. So as individuals, we can probably all agree that the persistence, the maintenance of some of these, or all of these SARA-listed species, if nothing else, adds tremendous aesthetic value to our experience. And Canadians, when they're polled, generally agree, which is no surprise, given the importance of wildlife in our national identity. You can just look at our money if you don't believe me. As biologists, we might not necessarily agree on how we should prioritize species, what kinds of initiatives we should take, and what kinds of efforts we should go to, but we probably would mostly agree that scientific information should be guiding a lot of our decisions about recovery of species at risk. Now, as citizens and as engaged citizens, we probably also recognize that governments don't necessarily share that point of view. And Canadians actually do protest from time to time, and this is an image from a rally, a protest held last July, that was in response to recent government actions to muzzle scientists and generally to diminish the role of science in policy planning. This is our recently replaced Minister of Environment, Peter Kent, last fall, saying in a press release that the Species at Risk Act probably needs to be revised to be made more efficient, whatever that means. Biologists, on the other hand, don't necessarily think that revising the Act is the best way to go, and their feeling is that it's not necessarily the law that's flawed, but the lack of vigor that's been applied to its implementation. And so it's against this backdrop that I and my co-conspirators, shown here, have done our analysis of recovery strategies. So what I want to do first is to introduce you a little bit, just a little bit, to the Species at Risk Act, and hopefully this will be background for the next few talks. So our act is fairly young, and it has a purpose that should sound familiar. It's to prevent Canadian indigenous species, so we don't go outside the borders, of wildlife from becoming extirpated or extinct, to provide for the recovery of endangered or threatened species, and to encourage the management of other species. That's also a difference with the ESA, to prevent them from becoming at risk. So we'll manage things that are not threatened or endangered. Okay, so SARA plays out in what we can describe as a four-step process with a couple of differences highlighted here between SARA and the ESA. First, assessment, species assessment and listing decisions are made separately. Species assessment is done by an independent scientific body, and their recommendations, if you want to call them that, are made public, and then the government makes a listing decision. And they can include various stakeholder and socioeconomic considerations in their listing decisions if they choose. Recovery is also a two-step process. Recovery planning is the first stage, so recovery strategies are the product of that recovery planning process, but they don't include specific actions, which don't get described until the recovery action plan. So as I mentioned, that first step is done by an independent body. The other three steps are led by government. The other distinction that you might have picked up is that the first and third steps are primarily science-driven, and they're meant to be that way, and that's how the courts have interpreted challenges to some of the steps. But steps two and four can include socioeconomic and other considerations. So those are a few of the key differences between SARA and the ESA. Here's a sort of a few more. For one, SARA is only 10 years old, so a baby in these terms. I mentioned that there's a separate scientific assessment and listing decision, unlike the ESA. SARA applies primarily to federal land. And in the bottom part of Canada, which if you look up, you probably, above the US, you probably see the bottom part of Canada, there's only 4% of that land that's federal. That's a big difference with the ESA. There's no delisting process. There's simply reassessment after 10 years by the independent scientific body. Recovery planning is two-step, I mentioned that. And I also alluded to the fact that status categories include not just threatened and endangered, but also extirpated and special concern, which is equivalent to the IUCN vulnerable category. Okie doke. So there's another interesting difference between Canada and the US. I mean, there are lots, but one of them is if you just look at the G rank of SARA-listed species, you'll see that most of our SARA-listed species in Canada are in fact globally secure or apparently secure. And that's not the case for US species. There's a far greater emphasis on G1 and G2 species. And in fact, what you can see is that if you look at the N ranks, so the Canadian N ranks, of SARA-listed species, they're mostly N1 and N2. Another way of thinking about this or fallout from this comes from these data. So on the left, you're seeing a map of ecoregions of Canada with more saturated colors showing you a higher number of SARA-listed species. So ecoregions that span the southern border tend to be our SARA-intense regions. And you can see that the proportion of peripheral species, which here we've defined as species with less than 10% of their global range in Canada, make up about 70% of our SARA-listed species. So it's a very different context in which we might think about recovery. Even though SARA is only 10, we have been assessing species for 35 years. So we're not that far behind in terms of assessing species. But what this means is that at that first SARA listing stage, there was a workload that just landed upon the agencies responsible for producing recovery strategies. So there were 233 species listed at SARA enactment, and 184 of those required recovery strategies. It's important to note that you don't produce a recovery strategy for a species of special concern, only for extirpated, threatened, and endangered species. That's why the numbers don't match. So if we take that and we look at SARA numbers, currently COSIWIC, that independent body, has assessed 676 species as at risk. 15 are extinct. They're not at risk anymore. 570 species are listed under SARA, so about 84% of the species that have been assessed have been listed. Most of the others, no decision has been made. That's a subject of a whole other conversation. 386 need recovery plans, and 187 have recovery plans. That's about 48% completion at this point. And there are just 7 species that actually have action plans on the ground, so there are no statistics on anything related to action plans. Numbers aren't there. We know that there are biases in the listing process, so who gets left out? And being left out at this point mostly means not having had a decision made. So who's lagging in SARA? Marine fishes are lagging. They are relatively rarely listed, so 12 out of 61 species that have been assessed as at risk by COSIWIC have been listed. Nunavut species, so if you look way up on the map, then you get to the Northern Territories, which are mostly federal land and have a lot of land claims issues. Those are also less likely to be listed. Aquatic species that are under the jurisdiction of the Department of Fisheries and Oceans are also less likely to be listed, as are species subject to commercial, recreational, or Aboriginal harvest. Listing decisions are slow, as I've alluded to, and there are some species that have been waiting for listing decisions since 2005. So since the first listing decisions, listing recommendations after SARA enactment, basically. So what's a recovery strategy under SARA? Well, it's supposed to be scientific, and the points I want you to note are that it's supposed to include a description of threats, statement on feasibility of recovery, a description of critical habitat to the extent possible, and a statement of population and distribution objectives. So what did we do? Well, we asked basically 3 questions. Which species have received their finalized recovery strategies as of June, I don't remember what, 19th, I think, was my last date of download. What are the features that are getting critical habitat described? So to the extent possible, is that being applied in some reasonable way? And how ambitious are their recovery objectives? And how does this level of ambition relate to some other features that we might be interested in, like status, global conservation status, and range type? I'm not going to address critical habitat just for lack of time. I'll be lucky if I get through the other two, actually. So let's zoom on. Some of the traits that we've looked at are listed here. They're, of course, a subset of the U.S. study. We didn't exactly have the same workforce. The analysis of threats is in press now. It's the only thing I want to point out there. So here's where we're at. We have 386 species listed in those categories that require recovery strategies. There were 363 strategies due by the end of 2012. You have a year to produce a strategy for endangered or extirpated species, 2 years for threatened. And we have slightly different numbers than on the previous slide because I'm accounting for what doesn't need to be done yet. 52% of the strategies that are due by the end of 2012 have been finalized. So we could clear the backlog in 5 to 8 years, especially if we don't make any more listing decisions. So which species are being prioritized? Species from marine habitats, surprise, surprise, you don't get listed if you're a marine species, but if you do make it through, then you're quite more likely to get a recovery strategy finalized or to have had one finalized by now. Terrestrial species are less likely. Arthropods and tetrapods are not doing so well in terms of percent completed, but fishes are doing well. And so what we've done is to take what we are doing, I should say, because this is in process, is that we're using a model selection process using logistic regression. And due to me wanting to add all the other recovery strategies from 2012 and 2013 and the students wanting to do their field work, we only have partial analysis at this point. But what we've done is we started with a model based on those two previous results, which have been consistent. So that includes taxonomic group and habitat type as covariates, and then that looks at the effect of adding one of the following. So that's as far as we've gotten at this point. I'm showing these, actually I'll just show you the results slide. I'm showing you that all of these have a significant, significantly more of the variation in who has a recovery strategy or not when they're added to that model with taxonomy and range type as covariates. And in red, you can see factors that are associated with being more likely to have a recovery strategy, and in blue, less likely. So if you're G1, you're globally imperiled, you're more likely to have a recovery strategy. That seems like a good thing. If DFO is responsible for you, you're significantly more likely to have a recovery strategy. If you're threatened, you're less likely to have a recovery strategy. If you're endemic, more likely. Peripheral, less likely. And we also saw that the number of provinces and territories in which a species occurs leads to them being less likely to have a recovery strategy. So more governments, more jurisdictions, slower recovery planning process. Also not terribly surprising. Okay, let's talk about ambition for a few secs. So we scored ambition under the three criteria that are used. Objectives have to be set with respect to numbers of individuals, numbers of populations, and overall distribution area. And we also combined these into an overall index. So we go from less ambitious when no objective is stated, although we don't penalize for not stating an objective unless you don't state an objective in any of the three criteria. Most ambitious would be to restore to historic levels. Here's just a frequency distribution of how those objectives play out with the three different categories, individuals, populations, and area within each set of graphs, and then the index overall. So the index doesn't count zeros, as I said, so that's why you see the pattern that you see if you're into that kind of thing and noticing what's going on there with more than current. We developed this into a numeric scale, or we binned them with numbers attached to them so that we could generate averages, which make us feel good because we like numbers. And overall, the average ambition index, I mean, you can see this here, maintain current is the most common type of objective. And it would be nice if I could say more quantitatively what the objective was, but really they're not quantitative objectives. They don't set quantitative targets. So the average ambition level is a little bit above maintain current, however you want to think about an average. The median is 2. Fewer than half of the species with objectives have objectives that go beyond maintaining the current situation of populations. So we asked really quickly, what are the features of the species with greater than 2 ambition scores? So do they have particular qualities that they share? Or we could have our little Ord's kangaroo rat asking, what do I have to do to get some attention? Well, you have to be more like a sage grouse. So we addressed a number of hypotheses about these, and I'll just run through a couple of panels of results. It does matter which taxonomic group you're in. You're better off being a bird or a fish. You do not want to be a plant or a non-avian tetrapod. That's our grouping. Okay, so better to be a bird or a fish. Also better to be endangered than threatened. So ambition scores are higher for endangered species than the other categories. But nothing else really emerges particularly. These are not significant. G rank isn't particularly important, and range type isn't particularly important. I'm going to get scooted off here, so I'm going to skip to just one thing. One question you might ask is, what's the relationship between those low ambition scores and being a peripheral species? Maybe we don't really need to be ambitious if most of our species are peripheral. But I'll highlight the panel on the right, which is from southeastern Vancouver Island. And in gray, you're seeing the historic distribution of Garry Oak habitat, a habitat that contains a very large number of Sarah-listed species. And in black, if you can pick out those spots, there's the less than 5% remnants of that habitat. And so even though things may be peripheral and they may be in peripheral habitats, there's reason to think that we should do better in terms of improving them. I think I'll just plain stop there because that's probably the best thing to do.